Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So you get your first 80-degree day on Saturday. And as the saying goes, sun's out, guns out. The summer of joy, which is what Mayor Triple Threat has termed this coming summer, has begun in earnest, even though we're still in the spring. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Absolute chaos. I mean, 13 people were arrested, 10 of them juveniles, downtown. Everybody met at the Bean, Dan. That's the place to go. And Peyton and Eli and other kids, we had a volleyball tournament, like, hey, we're going downtown. I go, oh, yeah, you're not. Because I know how the story ends, but it was a lot worse than people thought. Either jumping on top of cars, on top of taxi cabs. And it was just absolutely, like, separate fights were breaking out. That's what one of my police officer friends told me. And they didn't have enough manpower. They didn't plan for this.
Well,
so
I mean,
that's a problem.
How much manpower can you have? You had 39 shots, 7 dead, last count I saw over the weekend, not to mention these the unrest, the unruliness that was going on around Millennium Park, up in Boys Town. You had similar incidents. And this from Keith Thornton, to give you a little bit of description from a first-person account. Keith Thornton is the 911 police dispatcher who made some news at the end of last year when he sort of went public on Facebook to describe some of the problems with respect to police resources available versus police resources that are required. He wrote about this weekend, "I got my behind whooped last night. My ears are still ringing. Chicago was beyond lit and not in a good way. The 911 call volume was a complete wreck and most of the city was in backlog all day. People getting shot every other minute, several people killed, teens battering officers in downtown, foot pursuits, a vehicle pursuit, domestics all day and night, car accidents, motorcycles being struck, people unconscious and not breathing, five-year-olds swallowing quarters. Oh, my God, my head hurts." And that was just an 80-degree day. We aren't even to summer yet.
Oh, no.
"All I'm saying is stand by for standby. It's going to be a horrible summer in terms of crime, so shameful that families can no longer enjoy themselves without the fear of being shot, carjacked, or murdered."
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. It was, you know, in Boys Town, they were just jumping on top of cars for blanks and giggles. And this is what it sounded, I don't know if you saw we tweeted it out, but honestly, just would pick random cars and would have a dance party on top of the vehicle. Yeah, we're going to jump on this one. Why? Because why not? That was a windshield just smashing. And then everybody's standing around like a bunch of idiots and taping it because they want their social media moment. It is complete chaos. Of those arrested, 6 disorderly conduct, 3 mob action, 1 aggravated unuseful use of a weapon, and then they threw in 8 curfew
unlawful
violations.
Use of a weapon.
But,
yeah.
But, you know, they're already out, I'm sure.
So, you know, we've seen this before, so why should it stop? There's been no policy change. There's been no resource allocation change of any particular significance. We saw this in 2020 and 2021 over the summer with police squads riding around with people on top of the hood and jumping around
and ambulances.
On cars.
The ambulance dance, remember that one where they get back and they start twerking on it?
And so it was interesting against the backdrop of this weekend in Chicago. You had Christopher Wray. He's the FBI director.
Oh, yeah.
He was on 60 Minutes for basically a 15-minute infomercial where Scott Pelley played Ron Popeil. He talked a little bit about the spike in violent crime since 2020 and what the FBI is doing about it. Here's Christopher Wray's pat answer. Tell me he's not a politician.
Certainly the pandemic didn't help. There's a variety of ways in which that contributed to it. We're seeing more and more juveniles committing violent crime, and that's certainly an issue. We're seeing a certain amount of gun trafficking, interstate gun trafficking. That's part of it. And we're seeing an alarming frequency of some of the worst getting back out on the streets.
We're getting somewhere. Now we're getting somewhere. Speaking of which, number 16, we'll keep a running count just on this one category of repeat violent offender. Number 16 this year, after we had six dozen last year. Man shot his ex this month and her boyfriend last month. He was on felony bail. So he shot her ex-boyfriend last month. He's on bail, and he shoots her on Friday, weeks after he shot her current boyfriend in a separate incident, prosecutors said. 24-year-old wanted for skipping bail in a pending felony drug case where the shootings occurred, when the shootings occurred. He is now the 16th person charged with killing or shooting or trying to shoot or kill someone in Chicago this year while awaiting trial for a felony. The alleged crimes involve at least 35 victims, eight of whom died, in terms of the total number of victims, with the 16 people charged with killing or shooting or trying to shoot or kill. 16 people, 35 victims, eight dead. That's just this year so far in the first quarter after, as I said, six dozen last year. So it's very much like the border security topic. If you can't, in the case of border security, deport people who are repeat violent offenders, then we have nothing else to talk about with respect to immigration policy until you can accomplish that. And so it's the same with this. If you can't keep repeat violent offenders charged with shooting or killing or attempting to kill someone, if you can't keep them behind bars awaiting trial, then we don't really have a lot to talk about with respect to Kim Fox's office, the Cook County Prosecutor's office, because if you can't accomplish that, we cannot have a serious conversation about people in charge of keeping the city safe, keeping it safe, can we?
And part of the people that are trying to protect the reputation of the city is the mainstream media, not one station, 5, 7, 2, 9. Talk to people on tourists that were scared, you know what, Liz, and had to run back to their hotel rooms. Not one of them.
Michael Southside, here in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Amy. I say that we adopt Mayor Lightfoot's suggestion and address the root causes of violence. Bad political leadership, bad police leadership, bad parenting.
Yeah, those are root causes. Yeah. There's no question.
Because parents, you can't stop your kids from going downtown. Oh, we're just going to go for a little bit. No, you're not going at all. Because
Craig,
it's out of control.
Oh, hey, thank you. Good morning, Dan and Amy, and thanks for taking my call. Mr. Dan, you're a little bit off on one thing here. The leftists have been busy planning for this thing. They've been going after the parents at the school board meetings, going after the cops for basically the shots so they can get rid of the cops, letting all these criminals out of the jails, These leftists are out to take and destroy this place, and everything they do, they basically do just the opposite of what anybody that really cared about justice, cared about America or anything like that. They do the opposite, and that's why we're going to see this place just torn up and everything like that.
Thanks, Craig. Appreciate it. Bob, Buffalo Grove.
Thanks, Dan and Amy, for taking my call. Always good talking to you. I've been monitoring the deaths for years. I noticed 2 weeks ago we only had one dead. And then, as you pointed out, and I checked it out this morning, we had seven dead. What week is going to be the first weekend we get to double digits? It seems like when the weather improves, like you noted, the crazies come out, and I'm just wondering when we're going to see 12, 15 people shot.
Thanks for the call, Bob. We're going to see it. I mean, just year to date, just, you know, in case anybody's under the notion that it's been peaceful up until now, until the weather starts to break. Year to date, 823 people have been shot in Chicago and 174 have been murdered. It's a bit similar to the pace of last year. And again, last year was an increase over 2020, which was the highest number of murders in 25 years in Chicago until 2021.
Every neighborhood had violence. I mean, the new numbers are up: 41 shot, 7 killed. The latest shooting was in Edgewater, 3000 North Winthrop Avenue. Three people just started fighting on the sidewalk, and one pulled out a gun, shot the two victims.
Chris on the Dan Ryan.
Yeah, Dan, I don't know if you saw this or not. Maybe this is old news, but I saw a news clip a couple days ago in regards to Mayor Lightfoot being interviewed by somebody. They didn't show the person's face. He asked a question in regards to, you know, is it because of your policies or is it because that you're incompetent that the city of Chicago is the way it is? Thank you.
Yeah, that was at the City Club last week when she spoke. Thanks for the call, Chris. And she, you know, declined to dignify the question, which really wasn't a question. She declined to, you know, give it any legitimacy by comment. But, I mean, you know, people who know and people who don't care turn a blind eye. So that's your Chicago press corps turning the blind eye. And the people who know, they're the ones, black, white, Latino, other, that are fleeing the city or plotting to flee the city if and when they can.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We were talking about the Mayor Triple Threat's Summer of Joy getting off to a rousing start over the weekend with the violence, particularly on Saturday. You know, last year I said of the governor's race for Republicans, it was going to be a uphill climb. It still is an uphill climb. I said, I think I recall saying, it would take some sort of deus ex machina to knock Jelly Belly out of office. Yeah. Well, maybe that is coming, and it's coming in the form of the public's reaction to violent crime under the stewardship of Democrat socialists at the city and particularly the state level when we're talking about governor's races. Interesting piece in National Journal by Josh Kroshar. Rising crime is putting blue state governor races in play. In some of the most liberal states in the country, like Illinois, New York, and Oregon, Republicans are well positioned to contest the governorships on law and order messages. He points out Gallup recently finding crime as the third most important issue among registered voters, trailing only the economy and inflation. Those are sort of twinned. And Republicans hold a 15-point advantage when asked which party would handle crime better in a Fox News poll, which is the highest partisan advantage in the history of that survey. Also, I mean, just to put some color on this, we talk about Chicago and Cook County because that's obviously the biggest city in the state. It's the urban center. It's where a preponderance of the violence occurs. And because of the general, I wouldn't say incompetence, I would say ideological disposition of Triple Threat and Kim Fox, these are non-prosecution, decarceration politicians. But so is Pritzker. Don't forget that Pritzker signed into law at the state level.
Oh, yeah.
The same sort of measures you see at the city and county level, ending cash bail, limiting imposing more other restrictions on pretrial detention. And he's also made some very curious appointments to, like, the prisoner board, which have become a bit of a political football. One downstate nominee didn't get confirmed by the Senate. His nomination was pulled. You've had resignations. You had a police family just last month rightly go apoplectic against Pritzker after the Illinois Prisoner Review Board released a convicted cop killer who was sentenced to prison for 100 to 300 years for the killing of two police officers in Cabrini Green in 1970. The officer's family speaking out after that convicted cop killer was paroled. So, I still think it's a uphill climb for whoever the Republican nominee is for governor. But this landscape does provide for some surprises. And we've seen that since Crusher mentioned New York and Oregon. I mean, New York, we saw, and we mentioned a survey out just the other week that had Kathy Hochul basically within the margin of error, a better way to put it, Lee Zeldin, a congressman who's at least the front runner for the Republican nomination right now, within the margin of error against Kathy Hochul. I think she had a 4-point lead. In Oregon.
Oh, that crazy lady, Kathy Brown. Is she running again?
A poll commissioned by Oregon Public Broadcasting found that crime rated as the third most important issue in that state, like nationally. Only 18% of Oregonians said the state was headed in the right direction, 73% disapproving of the state's direction. Illinois is more like 85-15, wrong direction. And we also saw Kate Brown, who's not seeking reelection. Okay. Her approval rating was one of the lowest in the country as of the end of last year.
Right, she was out of her mind. Did you see her Christmas mask that she had? It was literally a tree and ornaments on top of cloth on her face.
And we also see in a generic survey in Oregon, the generic Republican versus the generic Democrat, just sort of testing, you know, where people are in terms of partisan disposition, that the Republican actually enjoys a substantial lead, generic now. You know, elections aren't generic Republican and Democrat. They're actually, you have to put people by those designations. But still, it does suggest that something may be afoot. And as we were talking about with respect to Chicago, as John Canzara, president of FOP, told us, expect this summer to be even bloodier than the last, which was bloodier than the last, which was bloodier than the last 25. And so if that is the case, and you see the same thing in other urban centers around the country. I mean, you're seeing it in New York City for sure. 41% increase in major crimes year over year.
And did you see Mayor Adams? He was also on 60 Minutes last night. I mean, you talk about a huckster. Oh, my God. I mean, he is so into Eric Adams, and it showed during that interview. But, yeah, back to crime here in Illinois. I mean, the bill that Pritzker signed. Also, if you're a police officer, you can get sued for just making, if somebody deems it a wrongful arrest. So why would anybody want to do that in the first place? And keep in mind that we still have 2,000 plus police officers, EMTs, firefighters who are not vaccinated, who are soon going to be put on administrative leave or just stop payment.
Speaking of law enforcement, there's something else, and this was part of the conversation that Scott Pelley had with Christopher Wray yesterday in that infomercial they did.
Yeah, I watched the whole thing.
Christopher Wray brought up the issue of, well, they both did, brought up the issue of the number of police officers killed in the line of duty last year, which was
73,
up
right?
Substantially. Here's Christopher Wray on that.
In 2021, there was a 59% increase in the murders of police officers. 73 officers killed.
Violence against law enforcement in this country is one of the biggest phenomenons that I think doesn't get enough attention. Last year, officers were being killed at a rate of almost one every 5 days.
But why are more officers being killed right now?
Some of it is tied to the violent crime problem as a whole. But one of the phenomena that we saw in last year is that an alarming percentage of the 73 law enforcement officers killed in the line of duty last year were killed through things like being ambushed or shot while out on patrol.
They were killed because they were police officers.
Right. Mm-hmm. Wearing the badge shouldn't make you a target.
Yeah, that's a fine statement, but why is it making law enforcement a target? That's the real question that was not explored.
Right.
So why do you think that is?
There's a lack of respect for police because people defund police. That's what politicians are saying. So why would an average citizen respect police officers.
Why are police officers being targeted just for being police? Pelley and Christopher Wray didn't delve into the culture change that perhaps explains that spike in police killings, meaning the killings of police last year. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
And on an ancillary issue, they went on to talk to FBI officers from the field agent in Miami. They were shot, you know, conducting a warrant on a guy who was charged with child pornography. And he talked about those agents. He could not care less about those agents. Do you see his response? I mean, it was just so calculated and cold and just insincere. And I thought that that said a lot about his character. So
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what's in Christopher Wray's heart. I'm not to suggest he didn't care about field officers being killed. That wasn't my impression. I mean, why? Because he didn't cry?
No, he was just, you know, I called right away to make sure that, you know, he wasn't out. There was no outrage. I mean, they were killed because they were law enforcement officers.
Pelley, of course, dutifully flacking for the left, also presented the false equivalence in this conversation, talking about police officers killed in the line of duty. But then also people are afraid, said Scott Pelley, playing the role of Ron Popeil in this FBI infomercial. He also said, well, what about people being afraid because of police brutality?
But, Mr. Director, some people are in their homes living in fear of the police coming through the door with a no-knock warrant. And I wonder how the FBI can contribute to the reduction of police brutality, which also occurs in our country.
Well, we take very seriously our responsibility to both protect the American people and uphold the Constitution. And that includes, where it happens, going after police misconduct if it violates federal criminal law.
Well, of course. I mean, it's so banal, this discussion. Who defends police officers who violate the law? We're talking about law and order. That, of course, necessarily applies to police officers, too. Now, there are some close calls and police-involved shootings and so forth. And we hash over them. We hash over them endlessly because it is so important that the police as an institution have the faith of the people they protect and serve. And police know that more than anybody. So I go back again to say Christopher Wray allowing that false equivalence to be presented by Scott Pelley was an abrogation of his duty, number one. Number two, rather than just giving me the pro forma statement about police being targeted because they're police, how about develop that a little bit more? How about a statement of principle, a comment on the culture with respect to this phenomenon, this 60% increase in officers being killed in line of duty last year, and you know the genesis of that? Well, how do you conceive of why this increase? There's none of that analytical offering. It was just the cut and paste statements, you know, about law and order on both sides of the blue line. Of course. Of course.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mm. And also, too, in the context of law enforcement, a little bit of comparison in terms of police-involved shootings that are not legitimate shootings versus the police officers killed in the line of duty, but versus violence against law enforcement, in addition, of course, to violence citizen to citizen in our urban centers. Any comment on that to disabuse people of the notion that their police officers are out hunting for young black men to shoot for no reason? You know, his job as one of the chief law enforcement officials in the country is also to disabuse people of, what's that word? Misinformation and disinformation when it comes to the rule of law and the real threats that are posed to otherwise law-abiding people. Is it the police or is it those violent criminals that are the beneficiaries of turnstile justice systems like in Cook County? Is it the police who are putting their lives on the line, quite literally, 73 killed in action, including as you mentioned, two of his field officers, two of FBI agents
one
last
every
year.
5 days.
So, you know, a little bit of commentary on all of the defund police, decarcerate the prisons, socialist Spice Girl agitprop over the last couple of years would have, it seems to me, been warranted given this rare interview that Christopher Wray offered to 60 Minutes. But there was none of that coming. And this is why, you know, Christopher Wray has been, to my mind, pretty big disappointment, and why the conversation, and maybe this is why he did the interview, why the conversation among some, myself included, is not about the FBI getting more involved in law enforcement operations at the federal level or this in combination with state and local. It's about the FBI being completely reimagined, to borrow another phrase of the left. About the FBI not being allowed to continue to exist in its current form because of the corruption, the politicization of its senior leadership from Comey forward. Oh, and something else they didn't get to yesterday, speaking of questionable judgment calls at best. Mm-hmm. In that 15 minutes, no time to talk about the FBI's failures.
Or about the lawsuit against them by Larry Nassar's accusers.
Even though that predates Wray, he's already testified before Congress about it being a failure. What about the Whitmer kidnapping plot?
Oh, yeah. Are those a bunch of goofballs?
Didn't have time to get to that. The two acquittals in that case and the inappropriate conduct of the special agent in charge of the Detroit field office who had to be replaced. No deep dive into that very high-profile case by 60 Minutes or Christopher Wray. What a surprise there. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You want to know why formerly red counties like Lake County have become decidedly blue over the last decade or two?
Why? I've always wanted to know. And same with DuPage County.
Terrible leadership. Yeah. Complicit. A Republican Party that's complicit with the Democrats. Republican Party local organizations like at the state level. Headed by snakes, people of no character, like Mark Shaw, who's the chairman of the Lake County Republican Party. Snake. Quisling. Enemy inside the perimeter. I don't know how many different ways to say it. And the proof is in the results. You don't have to believe me. Please don't. Just look at the results and ask somebody to defend them. So over the weekend, it's straw poll season now, and you know, I've done these both as a campaign operative dude as well as a candidate when I ran for governor. Did the straw poll circuit with the local organizations. It's a good exercise because generally speaking, when you go speak before a Lake County or a Cook County Township organization, you're talking to people that are activists. You're talking to precinct captains and precinct committeemen. Talking to people involved in the party that are carrying campaign material and knocking on doors and doing phone calls, at least some of the organizations and some of the people within some of the organizations. Most are weak, but some are not. So it's a good test. I mean, straw polls are not determinative of anything. No. I won a number of organizational straw polls, and obviously I didn't win the nomination. So,
and we had straw poll elections at a bunch of our Freedom Summits if it was an election year.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a fun exercise. It gives you a sense of where activists are and who's impressing people. And normally at these events, you have the candidates there and they're there to give a 2 or 3 minute speech. And for many people, it's the first time they've heard the candidates, all the candidates in the same room together and speak uninterrupted for a few minutes. So it gives you some sense of it. Which is why what happened on Saturday in Lake County, as per first-person accounts, is all the more curious. Tom DeVore is a Republican candidate for attorney general.
Right.
He's also the attorney that represented the class that ended, or that was the beginning of the end of the school mask mandate. He represented Darren Bailey when he sued Governor Pritzker over lockdown policies.
Good friend of the show, calls in often.
He's running for attorney general, as I said. He's staying out of the governor's race. But he was in Lake County for the straw poll because, you know, he's a candidate for statewide office. It's also an opportunity for candidates that are running for other offices, not just governor, to pitch their wares.
He saw something peculiar.
Here's his disposition going into it and then what he saw.
But yet I just watched cheating today happen, and it was disappointing. So if we're going to elect a governor of this state different than J.B. Pritzker, I have the desire for them to play by the rules all the time. And if they don't want to play by the rules, well, you know me, if I'm attorney general, I'll sue their ass.
Oh.
But we're not there yet.
No, we're not there yet. And what he's referencing, he addresses specifically what he witnessed at the Lake County Republican organizational meeting on Saturday.
So while we're there and the governor candidates are speaking, I'm walking around and I'm talking to everybody. And a bus pulls up. Yes, a bus. And I'm standing there and watching. Up pulls the bus. Out to greet the bus are people with Richard Irvin and Avery Born t-shirts on.
Okay.
Bus doors open and people start coming off the bus. Coming off the bus are elderly Indian citizens. Right? A whole bus of them. And as they're getting off the bus, there stands the Richard Irvin and Avery Born people. They had the shirts on that said it, handing them ballots that had already been filled out and marked with Avery Born, or Richard Irvin Avery Born, marked as the candidate of their choosing. We got our hands on one. I looked at it. It was already filled out and had them on it. What happened is Mr. Irvin bought, as I've been told, 150 of them before the event. He pre-purchased them from the Lake County people, which I kind of thought was inappropriate too, because shouldn't you have to actually show up and be a bona fide citizen walking in the door, signing up, giving them your information and paying?
How about even just being from Lake County, since it's the Lake County Republican organization?
Yeah,
you can prepay and you can just buy as many tickets as you want and give them to whoever you want. I don't know why they would allow that, but set that aside. So these folks, these people getting off the bus, I watched this young man walk up, and he was clever because he knew what was going on. He walked up and started talking to one of these people, and I was listening. And he was really nice, going, "Oh, how are you doing today? Where are you from?" They were from DuPage County, is what she said, at least. Not Lake. And it was like, "Oh, okay, you're here today for the straw poll. What do you think of Darren Bailey?" They weren't really sure who Darren Bailey was. And he was like, "Okay, what do you think about Richard Irvin?" This person wasn't real sure who that was either, but yet was there to drop the ballot. Walked in the building with their little ballots in their hand, dropped them in the box, went back out and got on the bus.
I bet they bought him lunch, too, or breakfast to get him on the bus.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
That sounds like a George Soros move. Because my aunt was a delegate in Nevada, and that's what they did. They'd take him out to lunch or breakfast, pick him up on the bus, have them go vote, and then bring him back home.
Yeah, it's not exactly a novel approach. Yeah. The fact that it was done so ham-handedly, it speaks to the competence of the Rahner team running Richard Irvin, in addition to their ethics. And it's the latter point that Tom DeVore had a final comment on. K Can we get that bite, please?
Yes, hold on. I'll try this.
Guys, that's just, that is insane. And then I see a Reborn post on their website how proud they were that they won the straw poll in Lake County.
Oh, my God.
That's insane. That is, you want to win a campaign that bad that you're going to cheat? Now, granted, that's not a full-blown election of our elections of our actual representatives, but it's a mock. If you're going to cheat in that, do you have any morals whatsoever? Why would you cheat in that? It's like, oh, my God, I was so disheartened, and I was pissed.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro. Text, I'd love to hear from Republican primary voters if they have a comment on that. Certainly would love to hear from an Irvin supporter, still searching for an Irvin supporter, I mean, given up on the candidate, of course, that has the courage to make the case. Still waiting for a case to be made.
And anybody that was at that event, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And we'd love to hear from somebody who was at the event Friday night, too.
Yeah, Mark Shaw, if you want to, you know, I mean, or anybody else who's happy to sell their soul for 30 pieces of silver, you know, that basically the establishment Republicans, as such they are, ineffectual, irrelevant, except as it comes to, you know, trying to get a little piece of some billionaire's cash to stay afloat or to stay relevant, maybe the promise of, you know, some status appointment if Richard Irvin wins or some such thing like this. But please, please, open mic. The floor is yours. Do we have anybody that will actually defend their position publicly? I doubt it.
Well, on
Friday, that's not how they operate. These are people who operate in the shadows because, well, they're cowards.
Well, on Friday night at the Northwest Side, a fundraiser that they had for the, you know, the slate of Irvin, Steve Kim, that whole group. And Steve Kim was there, and it was so uncomfortable, Dan. And when Richard Irvin walked in, I, you know, waited a few minutes and walked up to him. No idea about the show. I don't think he knows 560 exists. And then, you know, I asked the question, why are you supporting BLM, Black Lives Matter? And he kept avoiding me, and then I'd go from room to room trying to talk to him. And he is uncomfortable in his own skin, I can tell you that. And I am frightened that he is going to win because he is not a Republican. There is just no way that whole – and then so finally somebody else went up to him and asked him about BLM. You know, why are you supporting BLM? Why did you have Dr. Nzeke Day? And he said he supported BLM publicly to save the city from more looting. But the city had already started burning down to the point where he had called it or asked for the National Guard to come in.
Yeah,
it's a bunch of lies.
No, so that was his position. Uh-huh. Is I supported BLM publicly to save the city from being looted. That's his position. That's what he said.
Yep.
So let's explore that. Number one. So what you're saying is that you will capitulate to political extortionists because that's what you're describing Black Lives Matter as, and you gave in to a violent group of extortionists. That's the leadership. Number two, sorry, the candidate questionnaire you filled out where you called yourself a passionate supporter of Black Lives Matter, that was in March of 2021. That was almost a year after the BLM riot, sponsored riots in Aurora and everywhere else. So I'm sorry, what did you prevent in March of 2021 by issuing that statement in your candidate questionnaire? That's a lie. He's lying because he doesn't have a defense.
Right.
He's lying because he's a cipher. He's lying because you can't keep track of things when you just say whatever's expedient in the moment in what you believe to be service to your political ambitions in the moment. And then sometimes those things come back and bite you when you decide all of a sudden that after being recruited by Team Rahner and underwritten by Ken Griffin, you're going to be a Republican candidate for governor. That's what that is.
But at least some Republicans that were there were confronting him and asking him, you know, tough questions, too. And he wasn't running away from them because he, you know.
And they should be confronting all the Republicans supporting him that are participating in this fraud.
It's just uncomfortable. I felt like I was part of a big lie. walking in there. And my kids, too, I brought Peyton and Eli, too, and they were talking to him, and he just wasn't listening. He's like, oh, so you graduated from Tulane? My son said, no, I got into Tulane. I'm in high school still. it was just so uncomfortable. I'm just saying he wasn't even listening when people were talking because he was just avoiding certain people, and then he was just, you know, just a huckster plowing through a party. That's what I thought.
Well, something else about this rigging the straw poll, which, you know, by the way, has happened before.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Aaron Del Mar, who's Gary Rabine's running mate, rigged the Palatine Township straw poll against Jeannie Ives for Bruce Rauner 4 years ago. So I know Del Mar was at the Lake County GOP thing, and he pointed out that Irvin had bust these people in and that he was rigging it. Yeah, well, he did the same thing when he was committeeman in service to Team Rauner, and now he's not in service to Team Rauner, and so he's bitching about it. So not you know, there's some unclean hands at the table on this, too. But regardless, the point is not about Del Mar. The point is about Richard Irvin right. and Team Rauner. And what they do when they've got people like Aaron Del Mar doing their bidding, and what they do when they've got people like Mark Shaw doing their bidding. I mean, and you want to attract people to this party? You want to attract young people to this party to hold themselves up for office? Oh, because they will need to be anointed by the Mark Shaws of the world in order to stand for office, in order to get support from the Republican Party. This is why you don't attract talent and you don't retain talent and you don't win elections. That's what this is, another cautionary tale. And by the way, this rigging speaks of something else, desperation.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. For all of those people who are buying this bull jive that Richard Irvin is the presumptive nominee, do you find it curious at all? Do you find it curious at all? Let's put our thinking caps on. Let's pretend this isn't the first election we've ever witnessed. If Richard Irvin is the presumptive nominee, why hasn't he released a survey? Why hasn't he released survey results showing how far ahead he is? You know, when Bruce Rauner was running against Jeannie Ives, or Jeannie Ives was challenging Bruce Rauner, of course, he started 60 days out when, you know, because it was a late start in this primary election back when it was in March, as it customarily is. Bruce Rauner was up 41 points, and he won by one. But the idea was, I mean, if you're circling the field, then of course you release the numbers to show this is over. And then people fall in line and they just, you know, some people mindlessly repeat the, well, this thing's over and he's our best chance. He's our only chance to win and he's our best chance to win. And this is what's going to happen. They play political prognosticator rather than be a principled Republican and advocate for what they would like to see happen rather than just what they would. They think is going to happen and how often they've thought wrong. Richard Irvin hasn't done that. And I'll tell you why, because he doesn't have those numbers. I have numbers because I'm running a PAC that's supporting Darren Bailey, as I've disclosed on this show many times, independent expenditure PAC.
What are your
numbers? I'm not telling you what my numbers are, but my survey, I have survey numbers. So I can tell you why he's not releasing these survey numbers, because he doesn't have them. So for those who tell you the presumptive nominee because he's got Ken Griffin's money, the thoughtless set in the GOP electorate in this state, the lazy set, the compromised set, the Mark Shaws of the world, they are either lying or they're ignorant or some combination of the two.
But why was it so important to get the Lake County Republican vote?
Because
just
you want
a campaign ad to like generate buzz.
No, it's not a campaign ad. You just want to show momentum where there isn't any.
Okay. But they didn't think like they're that stupid too. They didn't think that people at that event were going to notice it. Well, where are you from? Or approach these people? They're getting off a bus.
Yeah.
From DuPage County.
Yeah. Well,
I'm surprised they didn't send them in from Iowa or Indiana or Wisconsin.
This just in, we have.
Resident journalist now.
We have a general lack of talent in the Republican operative set in this state, as we do the Republican elected set in this state.
Okay.
John in Palatine.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Good morning. I can understand that you're casting a lot of shade on Richard Irvin because he's just a Democratic plant charlatan. But I think more shame should be cast upon Ken Griffin. How dare he give his money to this clown who doesn't represent true Republicans, and because of the money, is getting a platform and advertising funds.
Yeah, all right, John. I mean, so I've explained why I think Ken is supporting Irvin. Mm-hmm. I think he is, you know, marginally engaged in the state. He's got a lot of other interests. So I think he's got bad people around him, Bronner people, and his gatekeeper, this Kasen Carter, who's a dilettante. The names aren't important, but the sort of process and structure is. Number two, he, because in part he has bad people around him, he has a complete misread on the landscape. And number three, Ken is libertarian. He's not particularly comfortable with social conservatives.
Right.
And he holds on to this shibboleth that a social conservative can't win a general election. Let me I'll take Jeff in Plainfield, and I want to make a Florida comparison, too. Jeff in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thank you for taking my call. Actually, I'm in your backyard now. I moved to Wheaton-Warrenville area.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to talk to you briefly about precinct committeemen, because you hit on a couple really good points. And the biggest thing we can do as a party and the people listening really need to understand their local representation. And I'm referring to the elections that nobody votes in. I'm talking about the one-off. The people that vote in the 10% local election right after the presidential election that we all clamor to go vote for when we know our electoral votes are going to be given to the communists. So what you should understand as a local, you can vote for your precinct committeeman. That individual can go like we did in Wheatland and threw out the bums and threw out the rhinos. And we voted and supported, used our little bit of pocket to support conservative Republicans. So when guys like you came and other individuals, we could throw our support behind the conservative candidate, not the Ken Griffiths. And it's really sad to hear that the Republicans, if you want to call them that, the feckless, that they want to throw the same kind of mud and slime and say, we're just going to bus in our own people and pretend to have some kind of grassroots support. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really great that you guys are talking about the precinct committeemen, the local representation, because that's how we take the power back from our own backyard, is to get people like us in there to say, look, we're only going to support conservative candidates, and then invite individuals like yourself. So thank you for being the bullhorn for the conservatives. Thank you for pointing these things out and continuing to shed light on the darkness.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Well, I mean, and the other thing that Jeff is pointing out, too, is that the precinct captains and precinct committeemen, captains appointed in Cook County, committeemen elected in the suburbs and elsewhere, they're quality control. These are the people that are engaged. These are the people that are working, volunteering, carrying materials, as I said, going door to door, making phone calls and so forth. So, you know, they're opinion leaders within their circles, certainly within their precinct as they're talking to their neighbors and so forth, which is why good organizations are important, which is why the lack of them, which the Illinois Republican Party has, is so damaging. But that quality control is important. And so people should take pride in the stamp of approval they give out to candidates. And when the process is rigged, like it was in Lake County, and it's been before, this wasn't novel, then it undermines the legitimacy of the local organization and the GOP brand more generally.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I saw a flag over the weekend at a restaurant, Ron DeSantis 2024, Let's Make America Florida.
And that's great.
And, you know, looking past his 2022 reelect this November, those signs. It's funny. Do you see any Pritzker 2024 signs in Chicagoland, even in the most dyed-in-the-wool blue areas, other than Pritzker's Mansion? Do you see any Pritzker 2024 flags anywhere?
Not one anywhere. And I don't even see the – I saw one bumper sticker, but it had JB and then with a circle around it, the red circle and the slash.
How did DeSantis and Rick Scott, senator from Florida, the junior senator from Florida, who is the head of the Senate Republican Campaign Committee, how did they become two of the most powerful and popular Republicans in the country? Rick Scott, if McConnell leaves, well-poised to be the minority leader or majority leader after Republicans take the Senate in November. How did that happen?
What happened?
In Florida, is it just that's Florida being Florida? Florida is just this conservative state, and so they can elect conservatives where we can't do that in Illinois.
No, but even Democratic leaders who put draconian measures in place go to Florida to vacation to have freedoms that their own people don't have in their states.
Yes, that's
my
true.
My favorite soundbite from Ron DeSantis said, every single one of them has come down here to Florida at some point in time.
So how did it happen in Florida? Oh, it was at the establishment Republican organization hand-selected these candidates, groomed them, and prepared them for stardom. Is that what happened?
What happened?
When Ron DeSantis ran for governor in 2018, he was not the Republican Party of Florida's chosen candidate. The state ag commissioner, a guy named Adam Putnam, was. When Rick Scott ran for governor in 2010, he was not the Florida Republican Party's chosen candidate. The attorney general, congressman as well, Bill McCollum, was. You're only a few years removed from in Florida Democrat statewide office holders. Rick Scott beat a three-term incumbent Dem Senator Bill Nelson in 2018. Barely, just as DeSantis won barely against Andrew Gillum in 2018. Both won by less than a percentage point. Florida's just this, you know, dyed-in-the-wool conservative state. Really? Charlie Crist.
I remember him, yeah.
Democrat, trial lawyer. He was governor after Jeb in the at the end of the latter half of the first decade of this millennium. He followed Jeb. So what happened?
I remember Andrew Gilliam, you know, former mayor of Tallahassee, now come out as bisexual. He was a Democratic challenger to DeSantis. And I mean, I don't know if it was fairly close, but it wasn't that far.
I just said they both won by less than a percentage point. It was extremely close. Both Rick Scott and DeSantis, less than a percentage point in 2018. Mm-hmm. And now Ron DeSantis is cruising to a reelect that's going to be a blowout. How? How did that all happen?
Because during the pandemic, you guys had freedoms that other people didn't. There was strong leadership. He wasn't governing in fear as all the other blue state governors were doing.
That's part of it. How did he ever get there in the first place? He was a congressman, but he wasn't the chosen candidate in 2018 by the party poobahs. Rick Scott is a kajillionaire, but he wasn't the chosen candidate by the party poobahs in 2010. You know, both of them pursued conservative reform agenda in a state that was swing to lean Dem, depending on the cycle. I mean, Rick Scott won re-election in 2014. That was no easy feat, given where the country was. And certainly 2010, obviously, he was buoyed by the Tea Party a bit. But, you know, Florida obviously was this highly competitive state at the presidential level, too, until recently. So you had two guys who were not selected by the party establishment, who charted their own course and made their chops on policy, conservative reform policy. And by the way, to give him some credit, I know he became a punchline in 2016, but Jeb Bush was not a punchline as governor. Mm-hmm. He was a conservative reform governor of Florida. In point of fact, he deserves a lot of credit for launching the school choice program that now is one of the most expansive in the country. In fact, Jeb Bush deserves a lot of credit for setting the stage, making the ground fertile for a lot of minority families to cross over from their normal Democrat selections to Republican selections because their kids were getting scholarships to go to better schools. And that's what helped Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis win in 2018, by the way, less than a percentage point. So go back to Jeb Bush. He may be from the party establishment, but he wasn't of the establishment as a policymaker when he was governor. He also sought Medicaid waivers to do things that were innovative with the state's Medicaid program to reduce costs, trying to do a better job of connecting consumer to provider. Conservative reform set the table to turn the state. And so the same opportunity is present in Illinois again. If you pursue the right policies, you get the political outcomes you want. If you pantomime the other side, if you dictate and say it's this guy's turn, this guy has been tapped by the poobahs of the party and he shall be the nominee or she shall be the nominee, then you don't. Even in a good year. And so with terrible policy undermining the structural advantages the Republican Party has ceded to Democrats over generations now in Illinois, you have a chance again. Will the Republican Party take it? You don't have to believe my analysis of Illinois. Look to other states where it's happened in both directions. Pursuing big government Republicanism is what whittled away the Republican Party into a center-right collection of kleptocrats, just as the Democrat socialists have become radical left kleptocrats. But some of them through the years, these machine politicians were, you know, sort of agnostic. They affiliated with the Democrats because that's where the spoils were. And now it's become a radicalized party. The choices we made. I mean, this is why a presidential candidate hasn't carried Illinois since H.W. in 88. Even when you had a couple of combine Republicans, well, it turned out to be, for governor in the ensuing 25 years. So, as we're just about 60 days from a primary election, here we are again. Do you want to try to pursue the Florida model and really change the future of Illinois? And gosh, look how quickly it can happen. Crist is gone and Nelson is gone and Florida is a jobs and people magnet. The same thing Mitch Daniels did. You know, Mitch Daniels, oh, Indiana, that's just Indiana being Indiana, electing Mitch Daniels and Mike Pence and so on. No, it wasn't. The Democrats had controlled the governor's mansion in Indiana for almost two decades before Mitch Daniels came along in 02. And look how fast he turned that state around with a lot of help from Illinois, as we have been pushing companies to locate and people to locate in Northwest Indiana because better quality of life, lower cost of living, better business environment, and so forth. But school choice program, same thing. The Florida model. That's exactly what Daniels has done. It's just the leadership has gotten a little weakened under Holcomb, unfortunately, rather than doubling down, essentially, which is what you've seen from in Florida from Jeb to Scott to DeSantis. Jeb to Scott to DeSantis. We could do that here. But you have to nominate the right leader first. And we haven't done that in the Republican Party in forever. Maybe it was the best choice we had of the available options in 2014 with Rahner. But we don't have to sort of make that Hobbesian choice this time around, if people are paying attention. One more chance to establish a beachhead and try to copy successful models that have been affected in other states, including those right around us. It's not like you need to look far. Will the GOP take it?
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Steve in Palm Harbor, Florida.
Hi, love the show. You're right on target. Everything you said. I grew up in LaPorte, Indiana. I moved to Florida 20 years ago. In 2010, DeSantis and Rick Scott ran as Tea Party conservatives for the Republican nominations. They were the anti-party picks and have prevailed because they've governed well and passed some good laws and made a lot of changes. The school system's lousy in Florida still. It's improved from where it was 20 years ago and 15 years ago. But I live in LaPorte. I have a stepson that's 14 years old. Thought the schools would be better up here, but they're not. I'm very disappointed. And in the change in 94 and the continue of 2010, you're absolutely correct what's happened in our country.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Programming note, bottom of the 8 o'clock hour, we've got Cassidy Campbell.
I can't wait.
He is sort of a partner in crime with Alex Primetime Stein, assaulting these, rhetorically, comedically, these city council meetings in the Dallas area. So we'll be enjoying his stylings at 8:38, so stay tuned for that. Yesterday, Fox News Sunday, Democrat Congressman Henry Cuellar, Texas, had this to say about Biden administration policies on things like energy and immigration and as he very euphemistically put it, the headwinds those policies are creating for Democrats.
Our companies are doing a much better job than other companies outside the United States and other countries. So we need to make sure we do it in a clean way. But I understand that if we're sitting there, so what is the concern? Let's go ahead and allow that opportunity to do domestic drilling so we can have jobs here and certainly make sure we don't depend on another country when it comes to energy. We do a much better job at producing energy. And again, we have to make sure we take advantage of that for our economy and for our independence. You know, certainly as a Democrat, I'm going to do everything to make sure that the Democratic majority stays. We do have some headwinds, as you know. And again, we got to make sure that we're all working together. And right now, some of the actions by the administration is not helping Democrats, certainly in South Texas. When it comes to oil and gas, when it comes to immigration policies, that has an impact on it.
Yeah, those headwinds are becoming gale force at this rate. Cuellar understating it for obvious reasons. And it's statements like this that are making Henry Cuellar's job that much more challenging. Climate czar John Kerry.
Oh, God.
We have to put the natural gas industry on notice.
Out of business.
You've got 6 years, 8 years, no more than 10 years or so within which you've got to come up with a means by which you're going to capture emissions. And if you're not capturing, then we have to deploy alternative sources of energy. No one should make it easy for the gas interest to be building out 30 or 40 year infrastructure, which we're then stuck with. And, you know, the fight will be, well, can we we can't close these because of the employment, because of the investors, et cetera. Or, yeah, or John, because we're trying to replace Russia's natural gas supply to places like Germany with our own, or because, as Henry Cuellar said, we're trying to be energy independent so we don't have to go with our tin cob genuflecting before dictators in the Middle East or Venezuela, John. You know, we just had Earth Day on Friday.
Did you get the card I sent you?
Yeah, it was lovely.
And the flowers.
Uh-huh. And that was also attended to some Buddhist climate activist setting himself on fire in front of the Supreme Court. I wonder what his carbon emission was on Friday.
Hey.
He's dead.
Why? Well, that's mental illness.
18 examples from our friend Mark Perry over at Carpe Diem blog at American Enterprise Institute, University of Michigan economist. 18 examples of the predictions made around Earth Day 1970 when this ridiculous environmental goofy holiday was, or holiday, I don't know, whatever. I guess everything's a holiday now. Day was, imagine, Harvard biologist George Wald. Civilization will end within 15 or 30 years by 1985 or 2000 unless immediate action is taken against problems facing mankind. Paul Ehrlich, he of the famous population bomb that was a dud. Population will inevitably and completely outstrip whatever small increases in food supply we make. That was April of 1970. The death rate will increase to at least 100 to 200 million people per year who will be starving to death during the next 10 years by 1980. Mm-hmm. No, that did not happen. Said that between Paul Ehrlich again, between 1980 and 1989, some 4 billion people, including 65 million Americans, would perish in what he called the Great Die-Off. Let's see. Peter Gunter, North Texas State University professor. Demographers agree almost unanimously on the following grim timetable. By 1975, widespread famines will begin in India. They will spread by 1990 to include all of India, Pakistan, China, and the Near East, as well as Africa. By the year 2000, South and Central America will exist under famine conditions. By the year 2000, 30 years from now, the entire world, with the exception of Western Europe, North America, and Australia, will be in famine. Now, as Mark Perry notes, the prediction of famine in South America was partly true, but that was only in Venezuela and because of Marxism,
right,
not environmental reasons.
And they're eating squirrels and stray animals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No choice.
Ecologist Kenneth Watt told Time magazine, at present rate of nitrogen buildup, it's only a matter of time before light will be filtered out of the atmosphere and none of our land will be usable. I could go on and on with all of these apocalyptic predictions that were made in 1970 and then were made again in 1971 and by the same crew or additions to the same eschatological cult every year from 1970 to 2022. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Joachim Book, who's a writer, researcher, and editor on all things money, finance, and financial history. Joachim, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and good morning to you guys.
Good morning. You wrote a piece on topic, tangentially, for the American Institute for Economic Research, Playing Fast and Loose with Numbers, and that would certainly include some of these environmental predictions that have the end of times sorts of predictions that have persisted over the last 50 years.
Yeah, absolutely. In that piece, I was looking at how journalists tend to distort what happens. Basically, they take the most extreme values of sometimes good underlying science, and they describe it as if it's the worst thing that's ever happened. And specifically in that piece, I was looking at the Amazon, and then I was looking at the ice, the Greenland ice sheet. And these things are humongous things, you know, like very few people, you know, have been to them, have seen them with their own eyes, or experienced how unfathomably large they are. So numbers don't really do them any justice. And so journalists, like, you know, they try to be helpful and like describe it to something that we can relate to. So they're like, okay, Greenland ice sheet is melting. All this ice is going into the oceans. That's terrible. How much ice is it? And then they, you know, like measure up all the ice and they put it in an Olympic swimming pool. I said, okay, that's not a scientific metric, right? But we can use it for illustrative purposes. Like, I can imagine an Olympic swimming pool and all the ice that melted off the Greenland ice sheet, I think the numbers I used was from 2020, so you had to picture 7 Olympic swimming pools. Okay, that's a big facility. I can imagine that. And then every second, so in the next second, 7 more of them filled with ice. Like, okay, now it's 14 of them. That's a lot of ice. Another second, 21 swimming pools filled with ice. Like, it doesn't take you many minutes or seconds to get it to the same, like, unfathomable number. You have no idea how much ice this is. This makes no sense. And I think that's partly part of the reason, you know, they're not helping you when they're trying to put it in that kind of quantities. Instead, they should put it in the quantities of, like, how much ice is there, you know? The Greenland ice sheet is massive, massive, massive. It's kilometers across, thousands of kilometers across, I think, from top to bottom. And it's shaped like a dome, 2 to 3 kilometers thick at its peak. There's so much ice. Like, what we lost in the Greenland ice sheet last year was something like 0.02% of its entire mass. It's like, I don't think you would get many clickbaity articles if you said, oh, Greenland ice sheet shrunk by 0.02%. Like, instead you get these, like, outrageous numbers of Olympic swimming pools that nobody can really relate to.
It sounds like you're taking pot shots at failed predictions.
Yeah, I do that too. I read another piece on the Arctic ice sheet featuring one of the most esteemed polar scientists called Peter Wadhams of Cambridge University in England. And for years, he's been predicting that we're going to have an ice-free summer in the Arctic. So the ice in the Arctic grows every winter and it melts every summer, but it doesn't melt entirely, right? And so there's multi-year ice that stays there. Since I tracked down a couple of his predictions from the early 2000s, and he's constantly said, like, in the next few years, we're going to have an ice-free Arctic. It's inevitable. The global warming is so catastrophic and it's happening so fast that that the Arctic is going to completely melt during summer. And this will be catastrophic for all kinds of reasons. And then I tracked him down. Like, he said that in 2009. He said that again in 2015. Sure. And then he had a book coming out, and he said it again in 2017.
Sure. Keep going. Rinse and repeat.
Yeah. Well, forget what I said in 2007 or 9. I mean it this time in 15 because I got a book. Yeah, this now
right,
it's
exactly,
real.
Right?
Yeah, now, and so, yeah, these are like sort of fun word problems. Are there more or fewer Olympic-sized pools of ice melting in the Arctic landscape in Greenland versus the number of football fields that are being deforested in the Amazon? And so you can see if you can reconcile force fields in the Amazon to Olympic-sized swimming pools in Greenland.
Yeah, they're just completely out of most normal people's imagination. We can picture one or two football fields or a few Olympic-sized pools, but we can't really like quantify the amounts. And like the obvious question should be, how many Olympic-sized pools are there, right? Like, if we're or say in the Amazon, if we're worried about deforesting this amazing, beautiful natural resource, then we should be concerned about how big it is. And the Brazilian Amazon alone, I think, is something like all the landmass west of the Mississippi in the U.S. Like, it's pretty big. That's a lot of area, and it's just Amazonian forest. Like, yeah, you get a couple of football fields every second. Like, okay, that's terrible for the natural biology right there and then. But maybe it's not the end of the Amazon, right?
Yeah, there's as you write, 5.5 million square meters of Amazon forest. And, I mean, how do you conceive that number? You can't. It's like talking about trillions of dollars. It's, you know, people,
Yeah, I have no idea. Loses like, relevance. Yeah.
Right. And so you point out that the headlines are deforestation surges to 12-year high. Deforestation in 2020 is the greatest of the decade, and all of these fear-mongering headlines. But then you put it in context, and again, you're talking about an infinitesimally small percentage of the expanse of the Amazon.
Yeah, and here's the worst part to me, though. I don't know if you guys remember. I think it was 2019. There was this massive, like all the pictures from the Amazon of burning fires, and everybody was writing. Mm-hmm. The French president was tweeting that this is terrible. Madonna and, I don't know, Leonardo DiCaprio, all kinds of people were
all
like
the deep thinkers.
So concerned. Yeah, we're really concerned about the latest thing. So I looked at the numbers, right? And it was like, okay, well, yeah, it's more than it has been in a decade, but that decade was extremely low, and it's still way, way lower than it was the decade before that and the decade before that. And then I compare, like, now it's been a few years, so I looked at the numbers again. Last year was 30% more than it was in 2019 when everybody was going hysterical about it. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember anybody being really upset this year. It's like, you clearly don't care about the Amazon if you're, you know, you should be 30% more upset this year than you were in 2019, but you're not.
Well, we were a little focused in 2019 on that turtle with a straw in his nose, and so we had to get rid of plastic straws and go to those ineffectual paper straws, because you know, we're polluting the planet with plastic and all the waste that you saw pictures of floating around in main tributaries in the oceans. And of course, then you know, we find out it's a relatively small number of tributaries and obviously a small percentage of the ocean. And it's mainly the responsibility of the Chinese communists. But it was used as a cudgel to beat up, you know, Western, you know, freer Western societies, because that's really the point of both the journalists and the people they're flacking for.
Yeah, I was in Costa Rica at the time and meeting a bunch of like very hippie, lefty, young environmentalists, environmentally concerned people who are, you know, the standard stuff like hippie clothes, bamboo toothbrush, really concerned about plastic waste and environmental things. And they flew across the Atlantic to be in Costa Rica, and this year, like Caribbean paradise, right? And they think that they solved the planet's problems by replacing their plastic toothbrush with a bamboo toothbrush. Like, really? Like, do you know how many times you need to do that trade to make up for the environmental harm you made by flying across the ocean?
And what seaside resort were they staying at, too, while we're at it?
Yeah, exactly, right? So, seaside resorts, doing all kinds of things, traveling there while, you know, buses and cars. Like, come on. Like, these numbers just don't make sense anymore. You can't say, oh, I'm a really concerned environmentalist, so I replace all of my plastic stuff with fake plastic stuff, and then you fly across the world and use all kinds of fossil fuels and you eat this and eat that. Like, really, that doesn't do anything. The numbers are way, way, way too small.
Yeah, you're just supposed to pat them on the head, say you're a good person, and move on, because there's just nothing else you can do with them, I think. Joachim Book, writer, researcher, editor on all things money, finance, and financial history. Joachim, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. FBI Director Christopher Wray sat down for a 15-minute infomercial, courtesy of 60 Minutes. Scott Pelley playing the role of Ron Popeil. I think that was in preparation for his big interview with the inventor of the Flowbee next week.
Right, exactly. Yes, it was a kiss-up interview, that's for sure.
He did ask who presents the greatest counter-intel challenge to the United States. Would that be the Russian communists or the Chinese communists? Here's what Christopher Wray had to say.
The biggest threat we face as a country from a counterintelligence perspective is from the People's Republic of China, and especially the Chinese Communist Party. They are targeting our innovation, our trade secrets, our intellectual property on a scale that's unprecedented in history. They have a bigger hacking program than that of every other major nation combined. They have stolen more of Americans' personal and corporate data than every nation combined. It affects everything from agriculture to aviation to high tech to healthcare, pretty much every sector of our economy. Anything that makes an industry tick, they target. We are now moving at a pace where we're opening a new China counterintelligence investigation about every 12 hours. There's well north of 2,000 of these investigations. All 56 of our field offices are engaged on it. And I can assure you that it's not because our agents don't have enough else to do. It's a measure of how significant the threat is.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by retired Brigadier General, Air Force Brigadier General Robert Spalding, former China strategist at the Pentagon, current CEO at the tech security firm Sempre, and the author of the book War Without Rules, China's Playbook for Global Domination. General Spalding, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So given Christopher Wray's description of the threat posed by Chinese communists, why aren't we taking more aggressive action against the senior leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, including President Xi, on the order that we're taking action against Putin and the oligarchs in Russia?
Well, the Chinese Communist Party uses deception and influence to achieve their outcomes. You know, I was a B-2 pilot. I dropped bombs, you know, on behalf of the country to, you know, put pressure on other countries to adopt, you know, our interest. Now, what the Chinese do is go directly to our corporations, our financial leaders, our academic leaders, and get them to be their proxies for achieving the outcomes they want. So essentially, they are basically undermining our political system actively every single day.
Yeah, well, no, I know, but we know who's doing it, regardless of the surrogates they're using. So why don't we go after them?
Well, it's because we tend, as Americans, tend to think of war as, you know, all done in force. And so the Chinese don't do that. And so they are counting on the fact that we won't wake up to this, because it's by our nature. You know, if you're smiling at us and you're saying you're a friend, but you're undermining us, you know, behind the back, that is not what we think to be war. And that is the way that they're doing it.
So we're making so we're making a huge mistake, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And they, so one of the things you may remember during World War II, the Japanese believed that they had caused, a great power to awaken because of their attack on Pearl Harbor. The Chinese studied this, and so they understand that things like 9/11, you know, force killing Americans, you know, that in a way that's very visible will cause us to unite and fight them back. Well, what they're doing is undermining us in quiet ways that doesn't trigger, you know, this tendency to come together and defend ourselves.
Well, what are we doing to fight back, if anything? And are we trying to steal their intellectual properties?
No, we're really not. And it's because, you know, we play by the rules. And that's why the title, War Without Rules, it's basically saying, hey, we have all of these international rules that, you know, most countries abide by. The Chinese say, hey, we're going to abide by them. And then they just don't. And they just break them, you know, whatever the cost. They don't care. And since we don't actually force them to comply with the rules and nobody else does, they get away with it.
So, you know, as an expert in this space, what would your policy recommendations be to a commander in chief?
Well, before, you know, I went to live in China in 2002, China wasn't a part of the World Trade Organization. They weren't a part of the World Health Organization. A lot of these international institutions that they've been able to essentially change to push their own policies, we brought them into within the last 30 years. And so, you know, understanding that they have to be outside, out of our country, we have to basically decouple with them. We have to move them out of having any kind of leadership position or influence in any international institution. Otherwise, they seek to corrupt it from within.
And instead, what we have coming out of the Pentagon is the big announcement last week that Lloyd Austin has finished crossing the T's and dotting the I's on that equity plan he's got. That's exciting. And also the Biden administration spending billions on making military vehicles more environmentally friendly. Wonderful.
Well, and the Chinese Communist Party basically uses that kind of thing against us. When we met with them in Alaska, the first meeting of the Biden administration, they brought up Black Lives Matter and how the United States is a racist country. So they actually use those things against us very cleverly.
Speaking of General Austin, so Austin and Blinken went over to meet with Zelensky yesterday. And some of the reporting coming out of there, in addition to discussions of weapons needs, is Austin saying that, you know, we need to weaken Russia in order to prevent Putin from invasions like the one he's launched on Ukraine. So other than equipping Ukraine to defend itself, is there something obvious that we're not doing that would weaken Russia and disincentivize Putin from these revanchist gambits?
Absolutely. The Chinese are the ones that are supporting the Russians with, you know, goods and money. It, you know, we're not doing anything to the Chinese. In fact, you know, the opposite. Our billions of dollars are flowing into China, who is in turn using their, you know, economy to support the Russians. So frankly, it's a big joke because all these corporations, you know, are saying, hey, they're for Ukraine, but then they're going and supporting China, who is actually supporting the Russians against Ukraine.
What is China's end goal with us?
Well, the Chinese Communist Party wants to stay in power, and they're afraid of their population thinking or learning about individual liberty and rule of law, all of these principles that are enshrined in our Constitution and that we built into the international order. So what they want to do is suppress those globally. So it's not just they hate the United States. We are their number one enemy, and that's because we're the leader of the free world. And it's about destroying these principles and actually getting the populations of the world to accept that democracy is bad. In fact, you see that around the world, and even in our own country now, people are starting to question our own system, our own institutions, and that's part of the process, is to destroy that you know, love of liberty that, you know, exists in the hearts of Americans.
We haven't heard renewed calls for a NATO or U.S. enforced no-fly zone from Zelensky recently. I presume that was a topic of conversation with Blinken and Austin. But as a retired United States Air Force Brigadier General, what is your opinion about the judiciousness of any sort of NATO or U.S. enforced no-fly zone over Ukraine?
Well, part of the problem with, you know, doing that is you have the chance of direct conflict between NATO, the United States, and Russia. Russia has nuclear weapons. So does NATO and the United States. So this creates a possibility for nuclear war, something that nobody wants. The Cold War was cold precisely because of that. We didn't want it to turn hot because we knew if it turned hot, it could destroy the world. And so the same thing here. This is going to have to be a long-term competition about who has a better system. And what we haven't been doing for the last three decades is investing in our people and our system. We've actually built China. China, who's using that, you know, largesse that they got from being connected to us to support authoritarianism around the world. So we actually, if we decouple and invest in our own people, science and technology, manufacturing, you know, infrastructure, and rebuild, then I think we're going to have a much better position from which to, you know, fight these Chinese. But it's going to take decades.
How has China used COVID to their benefit? And I don't know if you saw over the weekend, but in Shanghai, which they're now on another month-long lockdown, now they're actually constructing large, tall metal fences around buildings to keep residents in.
Well, lockdown wasn't in our lexicon prior to the coronavirus. In fact, the CDC, you know, for pandemic, their policies were voluntary quarantine of the vulnerable. So lockdowns were brought into the scene because China used it. And then the World Health Organization said, wow, China stopped the coronavirus using lockdowns. What they did is they just stopped reporting coronavirus deaths. All of a sudden, the media started reporting that China solved coronavirus using lockdowns. Meanwhile, if you go back and look at the numbers, country after country, actually, whether you lock down or not, the virus spread, you know, equally fast. In fact, Sweden had no lockdown whatsoever. and, you know, are doing quite well. There's no vaccinations in Africa is another example. So what they use is they use fear to get the democracies of the world to adopt policies that mirror the Chinese Communist parties.
He is retired United States Air Force Brigadier General Robert Spalding, former China strategist at the Pentagon, current CEO of the tech security firm Sempere, and the author of the new book, War Without Rules, China's Playbook for Global Domination. General Spalding, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This just came over the transom. You better tell your leftist friends to gird their loins.
What?
The Twitter board is set to accept the takeover bid from Elon Musk and Toma Bravo today. It's supposed to be announced today. This is an example of what you can expect the reaction to be. This from some fungible Dem socialist strategist, Daniel Moody Mills, on the Al Sharpton show on MSNBC. Okay. Yes, he still has a show.
Yes. I mean, I'm going to be honest. Elon Musk is a danger to Twitter and to freedom of speech. He has been known to say some of the most transphobic and homophobic things to his millions of followers. Mm-hmm. So creating an arena for hate, to me, that's what that sounds like, an opportunity for him to have no consequences, to have no flags, for people just to be able to do whatever it is and say whatever they want, with regardless of what kind of harm that it causes. So I think that this is something that folks really need to be paying attention to, because I think that Elon Musk buying Twitter or creating this quote unquote arena would be problematic.
Mm. I mean, God, I hope he buys it.
An arena is going to happen. Arena of hate. Oh, that's interesting. On the Al Sharpton show, Miss Moody Mills.
I mean, I hope he, you know, rips the company for censoring views and gets rid of all the board members.
They've been banning ads challenging climate change most recently. But Al Sharpton, saying this on the Al Sharpton show, somebody who led the riots in Crown Heights in which Yankel Rosenbaum, a 29-year-old kid, was murdered. Leading followers saying kill the Jew and talking about diamond merchants in New York, Al Sharpton, and the left has the stones to talk about arenas of hate. You got to love the left.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. When you hear the word mule, you think drug mule, you think of human traffickers.
Yep.
What about mules trafficking in ballots? That's what Dinesh D'Souza documents in his new film, 2,000 Mules. He begins, per the trailer, with a little bit of a roundtable discussion with some of our friends, like Dennis Prager and Eric Metaxas, about what they think about the 2020 election, and then provides some of the footage and evidence gathered by D'Souza, along with True the Vote, and what they think of the 2020 election after seeing the evidence. Take a listen.
We have put together, I think, the most extensive and inclusive voter fraud organization in the history of American politics. Let me say it again.
The 2020 election was the most secure
election in American history.
Let me begin by asking a very simple question. Do we know the truth about what really happened in the 2020 election?
I think millions of Americans know something went wrong, and they have little pieces, and no one's really put it together.
I'm agnostic on this question, and I am awaiting more information.
If I believed the president were a Nazi, I might steal an election.
Bold accusations require bold evidence, and they haven't seen it.
We have been working on something big.
Show me the money.
Can we meet? I've been working with Greg Phillips. He has a deep background in election intelligence.
True the Vote has the largest store of election intelligence for the 2020 elections in the world. No one has more data than we do. We identified in Atlanta 242 mules that went to an average of 24 drop boxes. But Philadelphia alone, we've identified more than 1,100 mules.
What is a mule?
Person picking up ballots and running them to the drop boxes.
This is not grandma out walking her dog. Bad backgrounds, bad reputations. They are interested in one thing, that's money.
And in no shape, in no way, in no time is that legal.
This is organized crime.
Do you have video evidence?
4 million minutes of surveillance video around the country.
What you're about to see is disturbing.
So this is 1 o'clock in the morning.
Don't we all vote at 1 o'clock in the morning?
One night, this person, this mule, went across 6 counties to 27 different drop boxes.
I call it the Mexican mafia, seriously, because they work like that.
This is jaw-dropping.
What you showed is frightening.
It's just sickening to me.
Now we come to the most important question of all. Was the magnitude of vote trafficking enough to tip the balance in the 2020 presidential election?
To explore that question, we're pleased to be joined by Dinesh D'Souza, critically acclaimed filmmaker, New York Times bestselling author. Dinesh, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Glad to be with you.
So the ballot harvesters, if you will, and the drop boxes and the video footage that you have, my first question is, you know, the laws with respect to ballot harvesting vary from state to state. So was the harvesting that you documented along with True the Vote in your film 2000 Mules, was it illegal everywhere it was documented?
It's illegal everywhere. And the key distinction to make here is between ballot harvesting and ballot trafficking. Now, it is true that in some states you are allowed to give your ballot to somebody else to drop it off. That's vote harvesting or ballot harvesting. California, for example, allows you to give your ballot to anyone. Now, in the states that we look at, the five key swing states, so in Georgia, for example, you can give your ballot, but only to a family member or if you are in a nursing home to a caregiver to drop it off. You can't. So what we have here is left-wing nonprofit organizations operating as vote stash houses, accumulating vast numbers of ballots, and then hiring paid political operatives called mules to deliver them. That is illegal in every state.
And did this in conjunction with True the Vote. So just give us a sense of, I mean, you heard in the trailer a bit of it, but a sense of the expanse of information and surveillance video that you poured through to put together this film.
Well, True the Vote did the heavy lifting here. They were our research partner in this project, and they bought 10 trillion pings of cell phone data. This is the movement of these mules picking up the ballots at these stash houses and then going from one drop box to another, to another, to another. Now, the reason they make these multiple stops is they don't want to drop 100 ballots into one drop box because that's going to raise eyebrows, a big spike in one drop box. So they have been asked to drop 5 ballots here, 10 ballots there, 3 ballots here, and so they go on sort of routes, kind of like the mailman. And they do it typically in the middle of the night wearing gloves, and you see all of this in the movie. And they also take photos of themselves doing it because that's how they get paid.
Wow. And the drop boxes came to fruition because of COVID, correct? I mean, while there are so many more drop boxes during the 2020
and Mark
election.
Zuckerberg.
Yeah, it's not just because of COVID. It is true the Democrats pushed for these drop boxes on using the pretext of COVID. But then what Zuckerberg did and others is they put a whole bunch of private money into the election, and they told these cities and counties, if you don't put in all these drop boxes, you won't get the money. So they used their leverage, the financial leverage, to pressure these cities and counties to install the drop boxes, focusing on heavily Democratic districts where all this harvesting subsequently occurred.
And this may in part explain how Biden underperformed Hillary Clinton everywhere except where it mattered?
This is kind of true. So the research methodology here was to focus only on 5 key areas. Atlanta, the greater Atlanta area, which encompasses about 3 or 4 counties, Maricopa County in Arizona, a little bit of Yuma, Milwaukee, Detroit, and Greater Philadelphia area. That's where the 2020 election was decided, and that's where all this trafficking. So I want to emphasize that the movies, we're not talking here about episodic fraud, a dead guy voting here, a guy moved out of his district. We're talking about coordinated fraud in all the key swing states of such a magnitude that it was much greater than the magnitude between Trump and Biden in those states in the election.
Well, how much were these mules being paid?
The typically $10 a ballot, although apparently in the Georgia runoffs, that number was considerably higher. So think about it. If you're dropping off thousands of ballots over a period of time, some of these mules worked 2 weeks in the early voting all the way up to Election Day. It was a pretty lucrative operation for some of them.
And you interview some of them. I'm sorry, Dan, for interrupting. You interview some of them in your documentary?
We have an exclusive interview with one of the mules whose identity we camouflage. This is a mule from Arizona, and it's very eye-opening because you get the mule's point of view.
Now, does that mule address the question of a fraudulent process, meaning they were doing something illegal with the transporting of these ballots from stash houses to boxes, but that the votes were actual voters who had filled out their ballots? Is there any delineation of that?
There is no way, if you think about it, for ordinary voters filling out their ballots to have those ballots end up with these left-wing organizations. What would be the mechanism for that to even happen? The ways, you know, we can look at voter fraud cases over the past 20 years. In a way, what we're showing in this movie is that this is nothing new for the Democrats. It's just that COVID gave them the chance to escalate an old-school fraud to a completely unprecedented level. But we're talking here about collecting ballots at nursing homes, collecting ballots from homeless shelters, collecting ballots from campuses where students have graduated and moved, but the mail-in ballots still show up. We're talking about collecting ballots in housing projects. So the Democrats have an operation to do this, and these are not legal ballots.
Now, what's President Trump's reaction to your work?
Well, we're going to sort of find out. I mean, he's all over the topic, needless to say. This has been huge for him, and I think he feels that this movie will provide the kind of factual vindication that he has long sought. I do want to emphasize, however, if you look at the movie, this is not a movie that is, quote, about Trump. Trump does appear in the movie, but he is not a major presence in the movie because I think the real issue here it goes beyond Trump. It's obviously the fundamental question of what is the point of calling yourself a democracy if you're going to have stolen and rigged elections?
Yeah, we spoke with John Lott about this topic, too. And one of the things that bedevils me about this is, you know, so now we're a year and a half removed from that election. And you would assume that all the election authorities have registered whoever voted in the election. And so you could compare the people who have been checked off as having voted in the election to the total numbers of ballots cast in places like Philadelphia or Milwaukee and see if there is a delta there, see if there's, you know, more ballots that were cast than actually registered voters having been counted as voted by these election authorities. But Lott suggests that we don't have that because the election authorities don't have that sort of record keeping, and they don't have that record keeping going back to previous elections for comparison purposes.
Well, he's right about that. What he's really referring to is the fact that the voter rolls are deeply corrupted. And by that, I mean, you know, people move all the time. And when people move all the time, there have been surveys that show that something like 13 or 14% of Americans move on a regular basis.
Right.
And yet what happens is even though there are all kinds of governmental agencies that have to update this, your tax records, for example, they know you moved, but nobody tells the election people. And so your name is going to stay on the voter rolls and you've now moved someplace else. Now, having said all this, I think that this is the roundabout way of trying to prove something. You're trying to prove a statistical anomaly. We have much better evidence in the movie. We have two types of evidence, the geo-tracking of the mules, which is basically a digital fingerprint. I mean, you can give your phone to your wife, but if your cell phone is moving from one Dropbox to another, it's either you or your wife who's been doing the ballot trafficking. And number two, we have explosive video evidence. So it's like when you catch the guys breaking into Fort Knox, you don't need to show statistical anomalies that their bank account showed a spike. You can actually see them doing it.
So do you think anyone will get prosecuted based on this documentary?
There is sufficient evidence in the documentary for there to be mass investigation, mass arrests, and mass prosecutions. And by the way, that would immediately uncover exactly who paid who to do what. So law enforcement has a major task right in front of them. The big question is whether the powers that be, the establishment in this country, and by the way, I'm including in this the Republican establishment, whether they will be motivated to move on a topic that the GOP, for one, is a little scared of. And that's, I think, going to be the key question. This is really interesting because the fate of this issue is in the hands of the GOP, not the Democrats. They're the perpetrators. The question is, will the GOP have the spine and the will and the resolve to pursue this? And that's really, that remains to be seen.
Now, provide a little bit more explanation on the geo-tracking. You were able to identify particular mules, then you get cell phone numbers, and then you can, as True the Vote did, ping them and follow them where they go, so you see the repetition of who's doing what, where?
Right. What you can do is you go back and you buy the data from October 1 through Election Day 2020. And then what True the Vote did was they said, look, we're not trying to catch every mule. Let's pick the most egregious offenders. Let's pick people who go to no less than five left-wing organizations, let's just call them stash houses, and 10 or more drop boxes. So in other words, if a mule goes to seven drop boxes, you're not going to catch that guy. We're only focusing on the most egregious offenders. And based upon that, we have 2,000 mules. The actual number of mules is vastly greater. Our movie ridiculously understates the extent of this operation, but it does that only because it eliminates any possibility. I mean, think about it. Some guy may have some legitimate excuse to go to two drop boxes. Maybe, you know, he was just scratching his foot and he happened to stay there for a few minutes. And so you don't want to have erroneous counts. So by choosing 10 drop boxes, can you think of a rational reason for some guy in the middle of the night to go to 10 drop boxes, if not to drop off illegal ballots?
Yeah, there's no, I mean, and why didn't they use burner phones? What a bunch of idiots, but I'm glad they didn't use them.
Right. No, this was an op. I don't think the Democrats had any indication that anybody after the fact could do anything. And to a degree, they're right. What they counted on was the fact that once you have an absentee or mail-in ballot, right, and you pull the ballot out of the envelope, the ballot itself has no names on it. So they basically figured that, look, this is a crime that once it's committed, you can't go back and figure out whose name was on that envelope because you separated the two pieces of evidence, the envelope and the ballot itself. So they figured this is a perfect crime, and they never thought anybody would catch them.
So on the 2,000 mules, do you have a name, rank, and serial number for those 2,000 people?
Well, not name, but we have the cell phone ID, which is the equivalent. So put it this way, from a cell phone ID, you can get a name, but the name has to be, quote, unmasked. The way you unmask it, so law enforcement can take a cell phone ID, they basically go to the cell phone provider and they go, who is this guy? They need to have some permissions to do that, probable cause and so on. So it's not a super easy process, but it's a completely normal process. It occurs thousands of times in the country every single day where there's a crime, someone's murdered in a park, there were four cell phones in that park, they go unmask the cell phones, they go interview those guys, they figure out who did it.
Well, maybe
a technology that's completely normal.
Right, maybe we can get some Obama administration veterans, they're good at unmasking, maybe they'll help.
There you go. Well,
great idea.
Absolutely. Well, I should say, you know, that this movie is out next week. So it's about a week away. Next week is our premiere week. We're opening in theaters. There's going to be about 300 theaters showing the movie May 2nd and May 4th. We're having a virtual premiere on May 7th, where you can basically join in by Zoom. You get an access code. You just buy a ticket. And it's all on our website, which is 2000mules.com.
All right. 2000mules.com opens next week in a theater near you. So take a look for that. 2000mules.com. He is Dinesh D'Souza, critically acclaimed filmmaker and New York Times bestselling author and the producer of 2000 Mules. Dinesh, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Cassidy Campbell is many things. He's a metrosexual.
Yes.
He's an ally of the trans community.
He's a BLM guy.
He is a man of science. He is a BLM advocate. He's many, many things. He's also very passionate. You know, when he addresses a city council meeting, you're going to hear something that comes from the heart. He feels things very deeply.
Hi, I'm Marty Epstein, and to start off, you may be wondering, am I gay? No, I am not gay. I'm metrosexual and a proud ally of the LGBTQ community, and I believe in science. Three things I love are minorities, gay men, and gay minorities. So many people say that they support the gay community and minorities. Meanwhile, they fail to take any action. However, I myself am very proactive and always prepped. Here are some ways that you can show support for the gay community. Go to gay bars so you can interact. He's laughing. And get to know the gay community. Contract HIV so you can have an understanding of where they are coming from. Listen to Elton John or Queen while in the car. And Lil Nas X as a last resort if those other two are not available.
Pro-vaccine, of course.
I am offended that our children are not receiving affordable gender reassignment surgery along with hormone blockers and access to abortions. This alone is a threat to our democracy, as Justin Trudeau only says. It just shows that you people do not care about our children, and that these are the same people who refuse to obey the science and get fully vaccinated. It's science, people. Science.
And most recently, BLM. Oh, man.
Oh, boy.
This
wow,
one.
He knocked that one out of the park.
Hoo boy.
What up, pimp? So, it's tax season right now. First of all, I just want to give a shout out to my kids. So, what time of the year I ever claim my kids?
You feel me? Wallet full of children.
But yeah, shout out to them. You feel me? What I was going to say was, so I just got my ancestry DNA test back, and I'm 2% black. The reason I'm up here today is because y'all trifling, and we need to honor my homie George Floyd, who now been sober 2 years, and this is finna be called the Say His Name Bill. All right? So this is my ancestry DNA test, if y'all don't believe me, 2%. So first of all, let's take a knee to the Pledge of Allegiance of George Floyd while I recite the pledge. Everybody take a knee, please. I pledge allegiance to George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement and the causes for which they stand. One sentence. I can't breathe with methamphetamine and fentanyl for all. Let's get into it now. Nobody took a knee, I see. I guess y'all are racist.
For more from Cassidy Campbell, live and in person, Cassidy Campbell, actor, comedian, and renowned YouTuber. Cassidy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
So where did you come up with what prompted you to think of the crying and the wailing as your – I mean, I love the Alex Primetime Signs raps, but the crying and the wailing, that's really a nice signature.
Well, to be honest, I didn't come up with it. This is actually what's happening in our society. That's how pathetic it is now. So I don't have to actually make this stuff up.
Well, do you watch MSNBC? Yeah, do you watch MSNBC to get your material, or how do you?
You know, I just see some clips here and there. I try not to really watch the news, to be honest. But you know, the comedy writes itself. Like, that's why this kind of comedy is just so easy.
Well, and that's why it resonates, too, is because it's about, like, 5 degrees hyperbolic, but only 5 degrees.
Oh, yeah. And some of the stuff, you know, that I do is actually people are like, oh, this is exaggerated. I'm like, no, it's not. You can go out and you can see what's actually happening, and there's people like this.
Have you received any blowback by chance, particularly to your Black Lives Matter promotion there at the Frisco, Texas City Council meeting? Because I saw some faces behind you as you were offering your public comment that didn't look like they were enjoying your presentation.
So actually, it's funny because there's a guy sitting next to the girl, the black guy, and it looked like he wanted to laugh the whole time. But the lady, like, had a serious face. But to be honest, you know, with the whole speech, I mean, nobody can really say, like, that's racist. I mean, that's, like, the kind of stuff the Black Lives Matter movement was pushing. So they would be saying that they're racist if they said my speech was racist.
And with respect to the city council meetings, we put this to Alex Stein as well. How did you, or how did you guys come up with the idea that public comment section at city council meetings is the perfect venue for this?
I mean, people have kind of been doing city council stuff like for since before me and Alex Stein.
Right.
And, you Party know, Alex bros. Stein's been doing, I mean, not like this kind of city council stuff, though, like where we act like this, but Alex Stein was doing this for probably like a year or so before I started doing it. And he's the one who suggested, he's like, yeah, you should come do it with me. And I was like, okay, sure. Let's do it.
Are you two really good friends?
Yeah. He probably talks to me more than, I probably talk to him more than my wife. So that's what my wife said.
You guys are like the 21st century Burns and Allen, the two of you at these city council meetings. There was an interesting moment, and I can't remember which city it was before, but where they cut your mic and Alex Stein got up behind you, and rather than go into what he had rehearsed, he just went after them and said, you know, you essentially you can't even let somebody have fun for 2 or 3 minutes, get their allotted 2 or 3 minutes to say their piece without cutting them off. And he just basically said, we're going to come after you. We're really going to make you an object of parody, so much so that we intend to help you be de-elected from your posts.
Yeah, so that happened in Plano, Texas. And actually, there's a Plano City Council today. That's the funny thing. And I'll be going to that. But so what they did was they tried to basically ruin this whole public comment. So they put the public comment at the end of the meeting instead of the beginning. So they moved it to a whole hour later, and then they cut the time to talk from 3 minutes to 1 minute.
And in Frisco, too, where you did that Black Lives Matter routine, before you were finished, some city council member basically said, you know, do we have to listen to this? And the attorney said,
right,
yeah, let him finish, and then we'll go into executive session and so forth. So starting to become more and more humorless in response to you guys.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, at the Frisco City Council, I saw one of the guys start to laugh. His name is John Keating. And then, like, when he saw I was looking at him, he got this, like, straight face. It is pretty – he had a sense of humor, I could tell. But anyways, the mayor, it's funny about him, is because he was taking a knee. He was marching with the Black Lives Matter in their little protest, which was funny because it's like 70% white people. And, and he was just pandering to the whole movement in 2020. And now all of a sudden, after he's done shoving this stuff down our throat, do I have to listen to this anymore?
Right.
Have you thought about coming up to Chicago? Because in one of your, rants, we heard you mention our mayor, Lightfoot.
In order to end white supremacy, in the name of the greatest mayor of all time, Lori Lightfoot. I love you, Lori. Bless you.
Have you thought about what he said?
Do we have to listen to this?
Yeah, that's right. But have you thought about, taking this, out of Texas?
Yes. The thing about Chicago is that it's only calling.
Oh, still, that's right, because of COVID.
I think we could identify some school board meetings and city council meetings around Chicagoland that are allowing for in person, that perhaps you could introduce yourselves to Chicagoland. We'd love to have you up here.
Oh yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, the thing is, like, if it's not like a really big meeting, it doesn't seem to be very like helpful. Like the smaller meetings, I didn't really notice much out of it, you know. But like those, like Plano and Frisco, those are like pretty big areas, and obviously Dallas. They're trying to screw us in Dallas too, because they don't like what we're doing. So basically, what they did was they put the first five people, the first five speakers to talk at the beginning, and then it's like a 5 or 6 hour meeting they have. Theirs is really long, and then those other people can speak at the end.
Yeah, trying to put you into the four corner freeze, a la Dean Smith.
So you just leave.
Yeah. And so now, are you guys, you know, we didn't ask Alex this, but are you guys conservative, or is it just you saw this is like a ripe area for comedy because it's just so ridiculous on the other side?
No, I'm actually super liberal. No, I label myself more conservative. I like whatever I'm saying in those videos, the city council meetings, I believe like the exact opposite. So I figured that was just the best way to get the point across.
So wait a second. Are you telling us that your dog is not really gay?
Unfortunately, yeah. Yes, I am. but yeah, I'd say more conservative. Unfortunately, the Conservative Party, you know, a lot of it is just seem like they're pandering so much now. It's like, we love gays now. Pretty soon it's going to be like, well, my friend is trans. I'm not transphobic. The Democrats are the real transphobes.
Somebody just texted into the show and said you need to parody Greta Thunberg. Are you going to be tackling climate change soon?
I actually had an idea to do climate change, like to start crying. The icebergs are melting. I'm going to die.
That might be effective and timely right now.
And
she's really great. She's really great. Let's listen to her.
So do you? I mean, you're an actor as well. I mean, do you actually audition for plays or TV commercials or movies as well as doing this style of comedy, because you're probably not going to get much work anymore?
No, I never have, actually. Other than being on this this show, it's called Vet TV. I did that, but that's a little bit different. I mean, and then I actually, you probably maybe heard of this show called Wild and Out on MTV. Yeah. They had me go to their workshop, and to be honest, I hated every moment of my life there. And they're like, yeah, it's not going to work out. And I was actually hoping it didn't work out, so I got sent home, because it wasn't really my thing. So
I like that, you know, we're always talking
comedy.
We're always talking about conservatives building their own castles when it comes to cultural institutions, television shows, movies, plays, and so forth. We need more conservatives in the arts providing content. Maybe you and Primetime Stein could get together and put together a little comedy troupe and expand the circle.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. I'm actually working on getting this my own, like, it's like a satire news network started up. Hopefully we have the first episode for our show this week. It's going to be called, the news network's going to be called Far Left News Network. And the show that I'm hosting is called Democracy Tonight, where I'm going to play that Marty Epstein liberal news anchor. And it's all going to be satire. And I think that's going to be good. Then maybe have some other people on there have their own little 20-minute segment, like, every week or something. But
Get together with Libs of TikTok and the Babylon Bee, you know, put together the whole team.
That would be great, honestly, because, you know, if you look at, like, all the other mainstream comedy, it's all liberal, you know, Saturday Night Live. I don't know what else there is. I don't really pay attention. But that seems to be, like, the main one on TV, and it's just not funny.
He is Cassidy Campbell, actor, comedian, renowned YouTuber, as you heard. Cassidy Campbell, a.k.a. Marty Epstein, will continue to look forward to your offerings at city council meetings and your new show as well.
Oh, well, thanks, man. Appreciate that.
All right. Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy going from parodies of the left to the actual left, worthy of parody. Randi Weingarten, is the noxious head of the American Federation of Teachers.
What is union, she pushing now?
Union goon. She was on a leftist talk show, and she had this to say about the Florida parents' rights legislation, now law.
Fame, it's this notion. And look, we're, you know, we've been very lucky in America, and we in some ways live in a bubble for a long time. This is propaganda.
Yep.
This is misinformation. This is the way in which wars start. This is the way in which hatred starts.
The way in which wars start.
Wow.
Really? Well, just in case.
What is the teachers union going to do?
Just in case you thought that the culture war was something that was being foisted upon the nation by conservatives. No, it's been imposed by the Randi Weingartens of the world. And most conservatives have been late to the dance over the last 50 years and even the last 10. And now more and more conservatives are starting to wake up and take notice and join the battle, as we've seen at school board meetings and city council meetings, for that matter. And that's the good news.
All right. Thanks so much for making us part of your work week. We want to give a big happy birthday to Emmett Quinn. Emmett McCarthy, Quinn McCarthy's son. He turned 5 years old yesterday, Dan. And you're going to turn 50. Look at how much you guys have in common.
Yes. One person goes off into pasture and another comes up behind him. That's how it works.
Yeah, so happy birthday to little Emmett. Also, thanks to Justin Quinn, our technical producer. We're back
Justin
here.
Justin Kosick is his
Kosick.
Name.
Kosick. What did
Everybody's
I just call
name
him?
Everybody's named
Quinn. Did I
call Emmett Quinn, Justin Quinn, Dan Quinn.
Let's go into the newsroom.
Mike Quinn.
With Mike Quinn. No, you stole my thunder.
Dan's the coach of my Detroit Lions. No, do not slander his name.
Yes. All right. Hi, Mike Scott.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.